they were interviewing a serial killer where literally he had had like a flat tire or something, pulled over with his victim in the car, got out, fixed the flat tire, went to get in the car, and the door was locked. And he knocked on the window, and his victim, who knew he was going to kill her, opened the door. Like, in her mind, she was still thinking, maybe there's a way I can get out of this. She opens the door. The keys were in the car. The car door was locked. Hey, this is Matt Cox, and I'm going to be doing a podcast with David Segura. He is the CEO of Glassbox Media, and they represent, I think almost 90 podcasters, and the bulk of which are, I believe, true crime podcasts. And so we're gonna kind of talk about that. And I appreciate you guys watching, so check this out. So, you know, like we were, do you know how we were kind of connected?
Yeah. I mean, I imagine it's because a lot of our talent has been featured on your show, whether it's Lance and Tim, who said hello. They told me to tell you to say they said hello today. Also Chris as well from, you know, Off to the Witch, you know, Jane as well, obviously, you know, literally a serial killer survivor. So yeah, I know you're immersed actually in the Glassbox universe.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. There's some interesting, you got some interesting people that you represent. Do you represent the Human Monster?
We do. Yeah, we work with Morgan as well. And as you know, that content's pretty intense.
Yeah, he was interesting. He was an interesting guy.
Very much so. I love his stories. I think it's really great. It's not everyone's cup of tea. It's so graphic, but I love it.
Yeah, he was very, you know, it's funny because speaking with him, he was very monotone through the whole thing. He never raised his voice. But I got a ton of his people that watch his stuff that came and made comments in the comment section. So he's obviously got like a loyal fan base because they all were reaching out saying, wow, I can't believe you interviewed this guy. I've been watching his stuff for months now or a year or whatever it is. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize, you know, how popular he was. But anyway, I was going to say, So I was talking to Tyler, and he said you kind of, you know, before we get into you starting, he said you have kind of an interesting backstory on how you kind of started this company.
Yeah.
What is that backstory, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, it's just funny. I mean, like, it's going to sound very weird, but basically I took 4 years off, you know, working and decided to start this new company. And, obviously super excited about it, but my background is basically a longtime media nerd. After finishing college and doing a job that was not the right fit for me, management consultant, I decided to go into startups, and immediately, you know, I just embraced the chaos. I'm like literally and figuratively ADHD. So it was definitely my cup of tea. And my kind of second startup I ever worked at was this for this amazing guy named Dean Valentine. Crazy name, but he was the former president of Disney Television, the CEO of UPN, did a lot of amazing work. And that company was called comedy.com. And, you know, not me, but that team and him were responsible for finding a young Zach Galifianakis, Al Madrigal, Tom Segura, no relation. And I just learned a ton on the job. But you know how it is. Sometimes in life, you don't get lucky, it doesn't work out. And the gist of it is that I saw the writing on the wall. Funny or Die and College Humor are both kicking our butts. So I decided it was time to move on. And I started this company called Giant Media in Los Angeles. And, you know, simplistically, what we were doing there is very basic. We were just developing technology and doing distribution on this native video exchange, we called it, called Giant. And the whole goal is to make videos either go viral or at least generate a ton of free earned media. And beginning with my buddy, Mike Dubin, who's more famous for being the CEO of Dollar Shave Club. You know, once we worked with him and that was an incredible success, frankly, we probably got more credit than we deserved. And as a result, that made it easy to get Gillette, Heineken, a lot of other amazing people. And we just grew like a weed. So, you know, what ended up happening there is it wasn't overnight, obviously, but we grew the company and we're very fortunate to be acquired about 4 years later. And yeah, before starting Glassbox, and I'll get to the story about Glassbox, just took a long break, did a ton of angel investing and traveling, probably a little too much partying. And, you know, eventually felt it was time to get the band back together. during the middle of a pandemic. And here we are today, and that's Glassbox.
Okay. All right. How long ago was that? That was, you said, in the middle of like a year or so ago, or?
Yeah. So the story's funny. Like a lot of startups, you know, it was just a bunch of folks shooting the shit, hanging out in my apartment here in New York, and just trying to figure out, you know, what we should be doing. And, you know, simplistically, what we ended up doing is starting the company in June 2020, but really didn't even settle in on podcasting or what we were eventually going to focus on until January 2021. So even though it's new, the company's been growing quickly. We have some really supportive investors and just a great freaking team. So I'm super pumped about what we're doing.
So what is the goal? Like what do you offer, you know, the people that sign up with you, or, you know, cause I genuinely, it's not like I know, I understand. Like I went to the website and kind of, you know, perused the website, spoken with Tyler, who's my booking agent. And, you know, he kind of told me a little bit, but, you know, it was, I didn't really get into it. So I'd love to know, like, what is it that you offer, like the podcasters? And you have like 90 podcasters. Is it 90 or is it?
Just a little under 90. And we're going to cross that threshold very soon. But, you know, you have the nail on the head. We have some information. Some people know us, some people don't. We are updating the website, but putting that aside, I mean, I think the real reason a lot of folks don't know us is that we're more of a B2B company. In other words, our whole goal is to help podcasters and creators, you know, maximize their potential. So not just earnings or revenue, but audience growth, you know, ad ops, just a lot of things that, you know, have to occur in order to be successful in the media space. So we're doing a pretty good job, we think, of that. But in a nutshell, what we are is a record label almost. That's the best analogy I can give you. We're going up and we're signing like star podcasters that might already have significant reach. In most cases, they already have 100,000 listeners every month. In some cases, they might have several million. And we've had a lot of success with this model and really using a lot of the learnings we've had, some of our technology, to really make sure that we're putting our talent in the best place possible to win.
Okay. What is the ultimate goal? Other than, I'm just saying, other than helping podcasters, like let's say for true crime, for my genre, because I'm a selfish prick and I'm genuinely concerned about myself mostly. So I'm saying like for the true crime, like here's the thing, like with the, I'll give you an example. I did a podcast with the way I kind of got started was I was in the halfway house and I was talking to a guy that ran a podcast company in St. Petersburg, and I was in Tampa. And I had a friend who said, hey, you know, he was listening to one of his podcasts. He said, you ought to contact this guy. You've written a bunch of, well, he was talking about real estate. He said, you ought to talk to him about real estate. And I was like, I just got out of prison for bank fraud. Like nobody's going to have me on a podcast to talk about real estate. But I did not understand what podcasts were.
Sure.
You know, I'd never heard one when I got locked up. I hadn't heard one. I'd listened to a few of them. I wrote a bunch of true crime stories while I was incarcerated, got some books published, wrote about over like 23, 24 synopses of guys' stories and like six or seven books. And I wanted to start a true crime podcast. Mm-hmm. But like a heavily edited true crime podcast, you know, heavily produced. And I didn't, you know, just didn't understand really how to even do it. So I contacted this guy. His name was Danny. His name's Danny Jones. He runs Concrete. They've got like 500,000 or 600,000 subscribers. I think at the time he had only like 200,000 or 300,000. So we talked several times and he asked me to come on the podcast to tell my story. And I was like, okay, so I did, you know, and it got like, in like the first 3 months, I think got like a million views. And I think it's like almost 2 million now. So I wanted to start my own podcast. So the problem was I was on a bunch of podcasts and I missed that wave, that YouTube kind of algorithm wave where everything I was doing was getting a million, million and a half views. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling an hour to 2 hour story. Mm-hmm. And I was on some big podcasts. But I didn't start my podcast for another year. Mm-hmm. By the time I started my podcast, I missed what probably would have been 100,000 subscribers for nothing.
Law enforcement often questions him, not because he's suspected of a crime, but because they find him fascinating. He is the most interesting man in the world.
I don't typically commit crime, but when I do, it's bank fraud. Stay greedy, my friends.
Support the channel. Join Matthew Cox's Patreon.
Mm-hmm. Then I started my podcast. I started interviewing guys. Well, several guys that have come on my podcast and told their story have been contacted by producers who've contacted me and said, we'd love to talk to this guy. And then, of course, I say, yeah, no problem. And I put them in contact because I didn't write their story. So it's just a podcast. I don't own the intellectual property as far as their story is concerned. So I just pass them on, if that makes sense. Like, yeah. I don't have an agreement with them. Like the guys that I wrote stories about in prison, I had them sign over their life rights to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that if those books, you know, some of those have been optioned. So anyway, mm-hmm. They contacted these guys that I've interviewed. And next thing I know, they're contacting me saying, hey, this guy's talking about optioning my life rights. I don't understand. And then I've helped them kind of negotiate that deal where they've optioned it for 18 months or whatever.
Wow.
And, you know, they don't have anything in writing. They don't have a story in writing. They just have their story that they told on my mm-hmm. podcast. So the options aren't great.
Mm-hmm.
Not like they were in Rolling Stone magazine, you know. So what I'm saying to you is, what I'm wondering is part of your true crime representation of these true crime podcasts, is part of your goal to turn those podcasts or the stories into intellectual property that could be turned into series or full-length films? Or I'm wondering if that's a part of the model, is I guess what I'm wondering.
Yeah, it's a great question. Basically, we're trying to make sure that the intellectual property is as valuable as possible. Part of the reason we gravitated towards podcasts in particular is that it's episodic. You know, like you're putting the work in, like literally daily, certainly over weekly output, and that makes basic really great content. So to throw it out there, I mean, one thing I will say about episodic content, we've learned a lot about the traditional media space, that they're pretty conservative. You know, they want to basically figure out ways to limit their risk. And I think one way of doing that is to be able to market to an existing audience. So to throw it out there in plain English, while I can't go into all the details, we are, you know, a minority partner in the Crawl Space Media Team's podcast. And really functionally, what we're trying to do there is help them explore new revenue, which is not just limited to audio or video podcasting, but could include live events. It could include book publishing, or like you mentioned, TV, whether it's streaming or terrestrial. Adaptations are a big business, and we know that eventually, even though it sounds crazy, we really do think podcast catalogs will eventually equal the value of both music and TV catalogs.
Okay. Well, obviously you have some YouTube. What is the majority of the podcasts? Are they the majority of them just audio or?
So I'd say this, it's funny you say that, because of all the podcasts that we control collectively, the number by far we're most obsessed with is our monthly audio downloads. And right now that's just around 10 million per month. So it's been pretty exciting. And I will be candid, almost all our business focus, monetization, marketing, a lot of it's really skewed towards supporting audio. But by that same token, I mean, Star Wars Theory, for example, it's a great podcast, you know, does really well within audio, gets almost 600,000 listeners every single month, which is awesome. But on the video or YouTube side, he does over 20 million. So in other words, we actually have more YouTube video views per month than we do audio downloads. We don't know for sure if the right move here is to kind of make our time and investment equal. But we also do recognize that at the end of the day, for some people, podcasting is a video first experience. And for a lot of folks, I can't speak for you, obviously, but you do both. And so as a consequence of that, I think we got to pick up our video game a little bit. The good news, though, is that a lot of the tactics that we use in audio work really well in video, whether it's barter, cross-marketing, and a lot of other tactics for really kind of supercharging growth.
So do you, one of the things that you do is help people get, or help the podcasters get sponsors?
That's a big part of it. So, and it's been a learning experience for us as well, meaning that we come from a world where we're used to working with some amazing clients like Gillette, L'Oreal, Heineken, you name it. And our original assumption was that, well, of course they love podcasting. Who doesn't? And what we found out is that a lot of those big brands, brand awareness brands, if you will, that are, you know, pay a lot and are easy to work with, they're still discovering podcasts. They're still getting used to them. So instead, we've worked quite a bit with more adventurous or performance-oriented brands like Manscaped, you know, Rocket Money, people like that, BetterHelp, Athletic Greens, and we like them. But we think one of the things that we can really introduce to really amazing creators that are working hard is a balance between advertisers, meaning that the people that already embrace radio and podcasting will be here, but we want to bring another class of advertisers into the fold as well. So yeah, very much so. Our partners are counting on us for that.
Okay. So what are some of the podcasts you represent? Some of the true crime ones or just in general, the bigger ones or.
Sure. I can talk to a lot of that. And like you mentioned before in the preamble, like you're exactly right. I mean, we are pretty broadly focused. Like we have a lot of comedy podcasts, what we call, for lack of a better term, like arts and culture, society and culture podcasts. But true crime, I mean, that's been in many ways our bread and butter. It's certainly our biggest category. And on a personal level, I really like it. It's one of my favorite categories, if not my favorite. And I think my Spotify like listening numbers attest to that. True crime's cool to be that, just brash business guy. What I like about it, especially on audio, is that 80% of listeners are actually female.
Right.
It's kind of crazy when you think about the implications of that and maybe the whys. But because of that, on the business side, it makes it fairly easy to sell, meaning that a lot of beauty and CPG brands, I don't know that they embrace like murder or crime per se, but they do like the audience composition. You know, they're trying to reach, you know, those listeners. So just from a business standpoint, you know, you asked about that before. One of the main advantages we have over any, you know, individual podcaster, no matter how good they are, is that we can sell not just their podcast, like let's say The Fall Line or Tim and Lance's Crawl Space and Missing podcast. We can cross sell that across relevant shows, Morgan's Human Monsters, you name it. So as a consequence, it gives us a huge advantage, and advertisers love that too. You know, they can just vet it very quickly and do a buy across many as opposed to just one or two.
Right. Okay. So I was wondering like, who are some of the, well, first of all, you mentioned one thing. You know, it's funny because I don't really do, like, I don't really talk to murderers and, you know, like most of my true crime is geared toward, you know, maybe bank robbers, maybe guys that have run scams, guys that do credit card fraud or counterfeit, you know, they make counterfeit money or that sort of thing. And so it's, you know, you mentioned that 80% are women. So, you know, 80% are women that are, and they're basically like violent. Mm-hmm. Those are like violent, like they're interested in, you know, the body was dragged and kept in the basement for 3 months, you know. Or, you know, they're very interested in like serial killers and murders and my, you know, I don't really do that. So as a result, and also probably because it's YouTube, I end up getting, I think I've got like 94 or 95% male audience.
That's interesting. So I would say this, the implications of that just at a super high level are that for a true crime bundle, it's a little bit of an outlier. Some people do buy it thematically, but in this case, like if we were selling the package, at least for some brands, like let's just say hardcore CPG or female brands, it'd be a mismatch. But hearing that, it's actually pretty exciting because even though it's probably like the driest takeaway I could ever have, I would just say when I hear that 90% plus men, I immediately think, okay, I know exactly who this appeals to, whether it's a Manscaped or Gillette, you know, these are folks that we can work with and that they'd understand exactly what they're getting. So
When I started, it was like 98 and 99. It's gone like over the last year and a half, it's finally come down to around 94, 95. Mm-hmm. I mean, initially it was almost 100% men. I thought something's going, what's going on? Mm-hmm. That was odd. But anyway, you were saying, yeah, you just end up gearing it toward a different product line.
I think so. Yeah. And it honestly be some of our product lines are pretty basic. When we sell like a bundle, we'll do like male interest, for lack of a better term. And so your show is different because it spans multiple categories. I would say that, but obviously true crime And if, you know, you wanted to slice it further, I mean, when I think of your show, I think of like the classic TV show, American Greed, you know, that's something that I enjoy watching, I guess, not a surprise, you know, as a man, and it's something that works well. And there's,
you know, always- I was on American Greed.
Sorry?
Did you know I was on American Greed?
I did not know that.
American Greed did a 1 hour special on me, and I was on Dateline, did 2 1-hour specials on me when I was on the, I was on the run. So it's funny that you say American Greed.
It's a great show. I will say that.
Oh, it was horrible. Like the, what they did on mine, you know, in retrospect though, it was 99% true, but you know, watching it, I watched it, you know, when I watched it, I was just like, this is horrible. It's horrible. But it was pretty much true. They just, you know, it's such a sinister twist on it. But anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I thought it's funny that you say American Greed.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean, though. I think at the end of the day, there's a market for everything, though. And one thing I will say about true crime and like the business of true crime, I think the brands are into it. They know what they're getting. But I also think behind the scenes, like the streaming companies, the big media companies, their biggest preoccupation is figuring out how to lessen their risk and get product marketed successfully. So even taking a step back, just putting, you know, Glassbox aside, because I think it's all intertwined with past experience I had at Giant and just investing. I'm also, you know, a partner in Dog Whisperer Productions. And, you know, the obvious asset, you know, the main asset we have there is 160 plus high definition hour long TV show starring Cesar Millan. So the way we monetize that today is Disney Plus, you know, licenses that here in North America. And then in Europe and Latin America, we license to Paramount's Pluto TV. And that's worked out really well. But the big lesson for me is like a typical startup guy, digital person, has been how, you know, conservative, frankly, American media companies are. So as a consequence of that, you know, what you bring to the table, what a lot of people in the true crime genre bring to the table, is that they can confidently walk in. It doesn't matter who they're talking to, whether it's Penguin Random House or Pluto TV, but they can basically explain that not only are they going to, you know, be open to adapting their program for television, but in addition to that too, they can guarantee significant marketing. So in other words, you have X number of video viewers per month, but you know, a company like Glassbox or a future partner has a number that's even larger than that. So what we typically do is we co-bundle that, and that's something that is also very incentivizing, apart from the story, apart from the talent, that makes it much more likely the show will get picked up versus someone coming in for the streets just off of pure creativity.
Right. Okay. So who do you represent though?
A lot of shows. So we work with different teams, like, you know, Tim and Lance over at Crawl Space. They have a number of shows, including Crawl Space, obviously, and then Missing. The Fall Line is another show that's also very amazing. It's a team out of Atlanta that has a unique true crime show. It's basically one where they're covering stories mainly of people of color, indigenous people. And the takeaway there is that their stories are underrepresented. Probably not hard to believe, but the bigger takeaway for someone like me was, and I didn't understand this until I really talked to them, they basically explained that while a lot of cases have a lot of widespread coverage and you can develop content based off of that very easy to do research, their cases aren't really covered in the mainstream media market. So they have to do a lot of primary research themselves and kind of like victims interviews. So it makes a show like that pretty special. And we've really enjoyed not only working on that show, but kind of a spinoff called One Strange Thing, which is still overall in the true crime genre, but kind of spins a little bit more into like history and even paranormal. So that's been another really fun show that we work with.
He's been known to cure insecurity just with his laugh. His organ donation card lists his charisma. His smile is so contagious. Vaccines have been created for it. He is the most interesting man in the world.
I don't typically commit crime, but when I do, it's bank fraud. Stay greedy, my friends.
Support the channel. Join Matthew Cox's Patreon.
One thing I'm kind of curious about, not to turn the tables too much, but you know, your team, yourself obviously have great taste. You've had a lot of our, you know, talent basically featured on your show, you know, folks like the Crawl Space team, Morgan at Human Monsters, Chris from Off to the Witch. And, you know, like you mentioned before, it's a little bit of a different angle what really drew you to like traditional true crime, like blood and gore? Like what really kind of gets you excited about those types of creators?
You mean why did I want to interview them?
Exactly.
You know, I, like I said, I typically don't interview, but interview, okay. I mean, I don't interview those like subjects, but those weren't really subjects. You know, those guys that they hadn't committed those crimes. I have a real problem with just violence in general. Like, you know, I'm never going to run into a bank with a gun. It's just not something I would do, you know. But as far as committing fraud, like, you know, you're making some documents, you're walking in, passing them off, you're walking out with a check. I got that. I'm okay with that. So I have an aversion toward, you know, harming someone. But, you know, I don't really mind. Some of the stories are very interesting. Some of the characters are interesting. And I'm very interested in the characters that just commit crime in general. What sparks someone to commit crime? But I don't really want to have an interaction I've had too much interaction with those guys. Mm-hmm. You know, they're frightening, and and it's funny. It's always like the quieter ones are always the more dangerous. So, but what, you know, my booking agent had mentioned, hey, he had spoken with someone who I guess was a booking agent with, on your side, mm-hmm. and he suggested I should interview, you know, these guys. And he came back, he said, yeah, you know, and when I talked to Tyler, I was like, yeah, but these aren't the actual guys. So no, these are guys that have done true crime, but they have a lot of different stories. And I said, oh, okay, I have no problem. Then I watched one of the episodes, mm-hmm. On, I think it was Jane. Is it Jane that was,
yep.
this? Yeah. On Jane with Crawl Space. And I watched the episode. It was actually her and a few other victims of different crimes. So I watched that interview, and then I watched Jane's, she was on Unsolved Mysteries,
mm-hmm.
watched her Unsolved Mysteries. And so I had her on, and she was, you know, she was pretty good. And then I talked to the guys at Crawl Space, and I'd seen there. So I, mm-hmm. you know, kind of started, you know, it just kind of spun, you know, off, you know, sure. from there. And, you know, it's interesting to talk to people that have investigated these cases. Like the stories that I wrote, I had to investigate while I was incarcerated. So a lot of what I did was, obviously I had the subject, but you can't really, this guy's in prison. You can't really trust what he's saying. Uh-huh. So I had to actually, and all through the mail, I had to order the transcripts. I had to order the Freedom of Information Act to get the police reports and the witness statements. And now luckily I had plenty of time in while I was incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And I would write letters and get letters back. And sometimes I would actually meet with people in the visitation room. Like I would meet with someone's mother,
mm-hmm.
or their father, you know, and talk to them, actually be able to sit down with them briefly and have a conversation. And then I would end up writing these stories, and I had plenty of time to do that. But it's funny because I, you know, you talk with these guys that have done the same thing on the outside, and obviously my level of difficulty was much higher,
mm-hmm.
but they, you know, it's this whole, you're a detective,
mm-hmm.
you become a detective, and it's so much fun. You know, you get that mail in, that email, and you start putting the pieces together. And before you know it, people that maybe thought they didn't have a great story, mm-hmm. have an amazing story, you know, or maybe they thought they had this phenomenal story and they just don't. And I was lucky to be incarcerated with, there were so many people that obviously had great stories, but I was able to pick out the unique stories. Like, yeah. if you're an African-American kid raised in the projects whose mother was a prostitute, his father's in jail, and you end up selling crack because it's really your only way out, the mm-hmm. way you see it, mm-hmm. that's a tragedy,
mm-hmm.
and it may be a good story, but it's not unique,
mm-hmm.
I could throw a rock and skip off of 30 guys like that in mm-hmm. the prison. Now if suddenly there was corruption and there was maybe, you know, maybe something happened, or maybe, you know, there's something that made it unique. Well, now we're talking about something different. Like, how do you tell that the same story in a unique way, in a different way. You know, if or how do you tell a story that's never been told? I have a story about a guy, which is extreme. Well, one, I wrote one story about a credit card counterfeiter, and I've optioned the life rights for him, and it's actually supposed to be turned into a Netflix documentary.
Oh, wow.
Working with actually two production companies that, you know, they kind of connect and they both make documentaries for Netflix. So, but that's a great story. But I have another story where I literally met a guy in prison who got 22 years in prison. He's a lawyer, disbarred lawyer, who's a rapid cycling bipolar with features of schizophrenia. And since was in his early teens, he has believed that God is telling him he's preordained to be emperor of the world. He actually stole nearly $200 million from the federal government. I'll give you some of the highlights. Like, this guy was literally, he had his own private militia, you know, like a private security company, right? They have contracts with the government to guard things in like Afghanistan and that sort of thing, you know, kind of like a little Blackwater type thing. I have pictures of him with George Bush in the White House at meetings. I have, you know, there was a documentary. He actually tried to take over the Congo. He backed a political candidate that was going to win. A bunch of his guys got kidnapped. There's a whole documentary on it. Trying to buy F-14 and F-15s, I think. Like, you know, you could actually buy them. So he's trying to buy like a fleet of them. He stole he ended up stealing like $200 million from the federal government. You know, he was in NATO, the NATO summit in Latvia, Riga. He backed that. He was one of the sponsors of that. Anyway, eventually he ends up getting indicted for tax evasion and he's sentenced to 22 years. And here's the funny thing is, like, everybody that was working with him knows that he thinks he's going to take over the world. Like, he was building a massive company in order to ultimately take over the world. He was a venture capitalist.
Yeah.
And it's the story, if you read the story or listen to the story, I actually have it on Audible. It's so over the top insane. You can't believe that no one's covered this story. And I actually just had a guy, so it's on my website. And I've mentioned it here or there, right? Like, I wrote a book about it. Because I'd love to get a documentary made about it. And in the hopes that it could spin off into something like a series, like House of Cards or something. What's interesting about that is that there's a guy that went on my website and found the story. And then he told the story and it got like 600,000 or 700,000 views in like, I don't know, a month. It may be up to 1 million by now. I haven't checked. His name is Count. He's a Scottish guy. He's Count Dukula or something. I don't know. Count something. He tells true crime stories. And for an hour, he basically almost read my synopsis of Frank Amadeo's story. And he got like 600,000 or 700,000. I don't know what it is now, but it's an amazing story, and I've had multiple production companies nibble at it. You know, it's like they want to do they want to do a documentary, but Frank can't be interviewed. Like, he's not going to be interviewed. So that falls apart. And so how do you make that leap to a series unless you do a podcast? And I want to do a podcast, but I want it to be a produced podcast.
Right.
Not me telling the story. What does that do for me? That gets me maybe 100,000 views. So what does that do? That doesn't do anything for me. Like, I've written a book, I've got a synopsis, I've got and it does well. I make a little bit of money every month, but my goal for that is something that I'm not really in a position to do anything about. I've got a bunch of these really unique stories, but, you know, between, let's face it, I just got out of prison. You know, the judge made it very clear I can't commit fraud anymore. So, you know, the things that I'm doing to survive is I do YouTube, I sell books, I do speaking engagements. Like, that's a 60, 70 hours a week job. And so my ability to also chase producers and production companies and be able to get to a position where I can get these things turned into documentaries. I've done well because, but that's only because people have seen my podcast and they've come to me. Mm-hmm. It's not because I've gone out of my way and hunted people down and be able to get meetings and flown out to LA or, mm-hmm. you know, these are things that have fallen in my lap mm-hmm. because I just don't have time to devote you know, and then you have to be very specific on who you pick.
Yeah.
Production companies will tie you down with an 18-month option and then re-option it and re-option it. It's like, look, that's great. I'd love to get 10,000 or 5,000 every 18 months. But the truth is, that's not my goal. Mm-hmm. You know, my goal is to get this turned into a documentary, mm-hmm. a series, you know, a full-length movie, something along those lines. And from my position, I can't do that. So, you know, that's where I'm at. So I've got some super unique stories. I just don't have the backing to be able to turn them to get the production quality that would actually get them the eyes that would be able to parlay that into an actual full length documentary or multi-part documentary, whatever. You know, and I actually, it's funny too, because I actually have a way to do a documentary about mm-hmm. Frank without his involvement.
That's interesting.
Did you ever see the story Anna and the Wolves?
I actually haven't, no.
Okay, well, there's also a series on Netflix called Bad Vegan.
Bad Vegan. I haven't watched it yet, but I've seen that, though, the call out.
So one of the characters in Bad Vegan isn't the real person, isn't actually the person. They have an actor play him. Mm-hmm. And so they do the interviews with him aren't him. Now later they reveal it. And so the audience is okay with it. Mm-hmm. In Anna and the Wolves, the entire interview with Anna, which is a multi-parts, is several parts. In the end, you find out that that's not Anna.
Oh.
Either Anna died or she wouldn't be interviewed. So they got an actor to play her. And everything that she says is taken from multiple interviews and multiple transcripts of interviews that she'd done in the past. Mm-hmm. So you have a whole documentary based on this woman, and it's actually an actor. And everybody was okay with it because at the end they explain it and they're like, oh, okay, that's fine. Like, they weren't putting words in her mouth. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a great way to pull off the Frank Amadeo, you know, that the guy that wants to take over the world, that documentary. And there's tons of, you know, transcripts. And of course there's my book, but even if you excluded my book, there's tons of transcripts. And there was a documentary where he was interviewed and there are multiple interviews with him, you know, and there's transcripts from when he went to court and got on the stand. He talked for hours and hours and talked about wanting to take over the world and his mental condition and his bipolar condition. And, and I mean, it is filled with gems. It is. It's funny when I did when I interviewed him for the book, he was telling me stuff. He's saying things, you know, it's insane. We're in prison. You know, he's telling me things. And then of course I'm getting documents in that are proving what he's saying, but some stuff you just can't prove.
Yeah.
And I remember when he had told me that he was trying to buy a fleet, like whatever, a squadron of F-14s or F-15s, I forget. Mm-hmm. He was trying to buy them and he was going to keep them in Crete. Or anyways, in the Mediterranean. So he was going to keep them there because basically they're declawed. Like they've taken all the firing mechanisms out of them. But you can actually have them move to like Crete and they'll put them back in. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is while he's building up this whole force. And he's in the process of backing this political candidate. Well, I remember him when I was thinking to myself, there's no way that this guy was trying to buy F-15s. Mm-hmm. So when I got out and I interviewed people that were working with him, mm-hmm. when I remember when I asked one of the guys about the F-15s, I truly expected him to say, that, listen, that didn't happen. That's not what happened. No, no. What he instead, what he said was, listen, I had nothing to do with that. Okay. Now, I don't even know if he was, I know they were negotiating, that he never bought the planes. I mean, I was like, are you telling me he was really trying? Well, he never bought them. And I was like, that's insane. And then I talked to another guy. He said the same thing. And all of these people knew that Frank would joke about wanting to take, they go, well, he'd joke about it. And I go, so you thought he was joking? And they go, oh no, we knew he was serious, but he would joke about it. Mm-hmm. They said, and he had these episodes. Mm-hmm. You know, they said it was so bad they actually had a psychiatrist on staff to try and maintain his bipolar condition. Mm-hmm. And they said, but you know, he did odd things. And I was like what? And they told me that one time he went to a board meeting. He walked in the board meeting with a Darth Vader helmet on, sat down and conducted the entire hearing in a Darth Vader mask, and nobody said anything.
that's great.
And I go, are you serious? And he goes, he said, I mean, you know, it was laughable, but you were also scared. He could become manic. He could fire you. We were all making great money. You know, it's funny too, because he had told me that story and Frank had said something about having a Darth Vader helmet. But then when I was reading the transcripts, mm-hmm. of his sentencing, one of the executives got on the stand and they were asking her about if she knew he had a mental condition. And she was like, well, I mean, there was definitely something wrong. She goes, I remember one time he came to a meeting in a Darth Vader helmet and conducted the entire meeting. She said he did do odd things. So
that's an understatement. Yeah.
I mean, I can go on and on. If you read, everybody that reads the book goes, is like, this is insane. And what's great is if you look him up, there's all these articles on him. And they talk about how he was trying to take over this. He was trying to take over former Soviet countries. He backed this political candidate. He had 32 of his guys were arrested, mm-hmm. in the Congo and held for 9 days. There's a documentary called 9 Days in the Congo. So, but anyway, you were saying, I mean, it's a bizarre story. And yet I get bites on it. People are super excited. But the moment they're like, yeah, but how do we, like, we can't interview this guy. And then this is how you can do it.
Yeah. You know what it is? I mean, I don't know. I don't want to talk out of school, because I'm definitely not an expert. I'm not a true creative. I'd kill to be, but I'm not. But yeah, there's a way of doing things. And like, people get scared about deviating from tried and true methods, because without going into too much details, I'll just say, and I think you have some exposure to the story as well. You know, we've done some exploration around, you know, the Green River, you know, Connecticut Killer, things like that. And apparently, at least the orthodoxy from people that know more than us, is that if a murder isn't solved, it makes it very difficult to, you know, talk about. And it's not just legal reasons, but it just is. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, there's ways of doing things that I think really could be rethought. I mean, for me personally, I don't want to be like that guy, but I think part of the reason people love the true crime genre in general is that they like playing, at least in the safety of their home, you know, kind of armchair detective. And the fact that something isn't solved could actually be something that's really exciting. So the fact that this mystery person cannot be, you know, interviewed, he's deep behind bars and they're not going to allow that. There's a lot of creative possibilities there. They're just the heart. And like, yeah. Don't understand like why that's a roadblock, but it is. I know what you mean, because I've talked to those.
Yeah. Like you said, they're very stuck in their, you know, it has to fit, mm-hmm. in this. This is a tried and true method that works for us. The problem is every time somebody deviates from that, or periodically, like there are rules, right? But periodically someone deviates from the rules and just blows the roof off of the place. Mm-hmm. And it ends up making 10 times as much money. Mm-hmm. And it's always some guy that everybody said, nah, that's not how it works. We can't do that. We can't do that. We can't do that. And then he finally finds somebody who does it. And it's insanely profitable and, you know, hugely successful. And everybody's like, wow. And then that pushes the envelope, mm-hmm. which is the Anna and the Wolves. That's what happened. That pushed the envelope. Mm-hmm. Hey, we can do this. Nobody else, everybody wants to do the story, but nobody can do it. And somebody said, let's get an actress. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure everybody said, no, no, no. And they said, no, wait a minute. Now listen, there's no difference between that and putting a photo of her up and playing the tapes. Let's just have a woman, mm-hmm. you know, or doing B-roll. There's no difference between that and having an actor and having some B-roll. Mm-hmm. That we don't have footage of that guy running in the bank, but we hired an actor to have him run in the bank.
Sure.
You know, so there's not a lot. This is not a huge leap, and it's been done and nobody had a problem with it because at the very end they revealed it.
Mm-hmm. So I'd agree. There's always workarounds, but I don't know. I will say this though. People love the genre. There's only going to be more, I think, investment from, you know, companies trying to figure out the streaming game, certainly in the audio space, whether it's heavily produced or not. So the one comment I will make that, you know, we talked to our talent quite a bit about this as well. They're talented. They know how to tell stories. They know how to produce content. There's always a day in the future, more partners, more money, more time, where production quality can be increased. But I'm a really big believer in just getting the story out there. So one way or another, even if it's like stripped down, if it's something that's more simple, more kind of in your face, at least in the podcast space, whether we're talking about YouTube or audio, people actually like that. We've actually seen, like, you know, some of the improvements we thought we were making were actually probably more harmful than good. In other words, people have a certain expectation that it'll be like raw, even small errors or something kind of add to like the authenticity of it. So no matter how good the story is, I would say that, you know, it's best. So believe me, you know, you got to stick to what you know, but a limited series of like you covering this over 6 or 9 podcasts could be a hell of a way to build attention and to make it more enticing to get the right production partner that's willing to actually put funds to kind of get it done, to actually make sure it turns into what you want.
Yeah, I've thought about that because I actually did like a 25 part series on my life, mm-hmm. all the way from my crimes up to prison and from being in prison onward. Mm-hmm. And I thought about going back because I did like one 45 minute episode on Frank because he was a big part of my story while I was incarcerated because he was representing inmates in prison on their cases and he represented me on my case. Mm-hmm. And I know you don't really know anything about my case, but I initially got 26 years. Mm-hmm. I got my sentence reduced twice. Wow. Frank represented me on both of those. So Frank acted as my lawyer from inside of prison. He got 7 years knocked off my sentence the first time, fought the government. They didn't want to do it. And then he went back and fought again a year later and got another 5 years knocked off. Wow. Like my initial release date was 2030. I'm supposed to be in prison right now. So if it weren't for this guy, like I literally, if I really start talking about what I owe him, I immediately get choked up. Mm-hmm. You know, which is one of the reasons I would love to get the story out there.
Sure.
Because it's not just that he's this crazy guy. You know, I always joke that he's a James Bond villain. You know, he's building Spectre to take over the world. Like I've never met anybody like that in prison. I've met a lot of guys. That's insane. But a great story. And this is also a guy who's in prison representing prisoners and walking people out the door. Everybody, you know, every lawyer I talked to on the street told me I didn't have a chance. Mm-hmm. Do you know how many he filed something called a 2255? Okay, it's a habeas motion. For every 3,500 2255s that are filed in the federal system for an inmate, one gets relief. Huh. He filed 2 for me and got relief on both of them. He is an amazing individual. Wow. So, you know, when I say he's crazy and this and that, like, I don't mean it disrespectfully because he'll tell you he's crazy. Mm-hmm. He'll say, yeah, it's not normal. You're right. I agree. It's not normal. You know, he laughs about it, which just makes him even better. He's so likable. Like you want someone like that to succeed. And I didn't even let him do my work on my stuff. Didn't even approach him because, you know, he's talking about people are saying this guy thinks he's going to take over the world. Like I'm reading articles about him. Like this guy's insane. You know, this is why who steals $200 million from the federal government doesn't think it's going to catch up with him. And thing goes to prison and he's, but I, over the years, I start watching him represent people and they're leaving prison. Or people would come and say, hey, Frank just got 10 years knocked off of, Johnny Thompson's sentence. And I'd be like, what? Yeah. Or, hey, he just got 5 years knocked off this guy. Hey, this guy got immediate release and he's leaving. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, and so finally I just went up to him. I said, look, Frank, here's what's going on. And I showed him my paperwork. We looked over it and he said, I won't let the government do this. I will take on this case. I'm like, yeah, okay. And then he would go into a manic mode and he'd say, when my legions march on Washington, I'm going to burn the Constitution and I will have the president kneel at my feet. And you'd sit there and you'd look at him and he'd take a deep breath and he'd go, okay, I'm fine. Listen, just go ahead and get me your indictment. I'm going to need your motions. I'm going to need this. And he starts talking, I need this and this. And you go, okay, fine. He goes, okay, thanks. Get that to me by Tuesday. I'll take care of it. Okay. So he'd have these little spikes of insanity and then he'd come back down. Everybody knew just stop and wait. Mm-hmm. You wait. He comes back down. He's perfectly fine again. And this is the guy that did my legal work.
Wow.
And when all the sane attorneys said, yeah, you don't have a prayer.
Jeez.
So I can't pay you to represent me. Frank did it for nothing.
Wow.
So anyway, amazing guy, truly insane. But just an overall insane, amazing story that you just can't, like, I actually need to get your address. I'll mail you the book if you want, if you're interested.
Oh, I love that. That'd be great.
It's like 180 pages or something. But it's a very fun read.
I'm already looking forward to it. I can tell you that right now. So that's awesome.
Well, I definitely should do I'll probably take your advice. I mean, I do need to do a multi-part series and just slowly go through it piece by piece.
Yeah. I hear that. I mean, I'll put it this way. Like I have to admit though, my advice is always going to be pretty similar to what I would do in any given situation, but I'm a startup guy. So I always know that feeling like we're not ready yet. We'll be more ready next year. If we have this, then we can do it. And that day never comes. So it's always best now, kind of go with what you have. And it also gives people more of a proof of concept, positive, something like that would work. And I think the one thing that, I'd love to do, even if it's just informally with our company, with Nick, who is just on right now, our marketing team, the way we've actually grown all these podcasts is not through paid media. It's actually through barter. And YouTube and audio are very similar. What we typically do is have our shows that are similar, or even third-party shows with so-called rivals. And we just basically trade placements and barter spots. And that's one of the main value adds that Glassbox brings to the table. And we know it would work for you as well. It's just an exciting thing. It's an easy way to grow the podcast where people ask for a promotion, basically, or a shout out from you. And as long as it's being done in an orderly way, we're tracking that literally in real time with technology and we see what converts better. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's kind of like going on someone else's podcast and you hope that you kind of convert some of their subscribers or viewers, and same thing. Well, you're saying you actually do like a, so they give them a shout out.
Exactly. So
is that I noticed that on Crawl Space where they mentioned somebody, it was very casual and it didn't seem like an advertisement at all.
That's part of it. And the other parts are more explicitly ads. They're trailers. And the feedback, just to be candid there, a lot of hosts like yourself are like, well, look, it's very personal. I'd rather read it myself. I'm comfortable as long as I like the show and the people. And we get that. But you know what ends up happening? People are busy. They have other things they need to do. It just falls by the wayside eventually. So what we've done to automate this process and make it more scalable, especially in audio, is that we'll work with all of our hosts, come up with a really killer 30-second trailer that they mostly do. Once we have these, what we do is we run that in inventory that's unsold. And not only will we trade that on Glassbox Podcast, but Crawl Space and even third-party companies like Cast Media or Pushkin Media, which is Malcolm Gladwell's company, will trade as many as 1 million impressions, basically ads a month. No money changes hands, but we're all measuring in real time. All right, for every 1,000 listens, how many downloads or RSS subscribers do we gain from this? So it's literally people helping each other and all the boats being lifted. It's an amazing way to grow an audience.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
It works. So we'd love to continue the conversation there too.
Okay. Well, can you think of anything else?
I mean, I guess the biggest thing, just taking a step back and even looking at, you know, like Tyler's notes and some of the things that he was curious about, I'll just say that I think you know this better than anyone. You're living it. But true crime is a genre. It's just amazing. It's a category that I think connects with a lot of people, especially in the States. There's a lot of things that you can do, whether it's audio or video. And then, of course, the derivatives business, whether we're talking about books, TV adaptations, live events, it's just a really rich genre. So we just encourage everyone who's like building out there, everyone who's like, you know, kind of doing what they need to day to day to stick with it. Because the one comment I will make is that we've seen some amazing stuff on our podcast, whether it's true crime or other genres. People basically just all of a sudden, almost overnight, go from anywhere from 200,000 downloads a month to over 600,000. In fact, the first ever show we ever signed was called Going West. They're an amazing show, team out of Boise, actually boyfriend, girlfriend team. And they started this like not so many years ago, literally, I think in their garage. And when we first signed them, they were doing around 300,000 monthly downloads and added tragedy. But, you know, I think they did a good job of balancing the ethics with pop news. When the Gabby Petito case broke, it really triggered something in the primary host, Daphne. And I didn't even know this, and it's a shame on me for not knowing this, but it turns out that I think, you know, she had an aunt that she never met that went missing. And so she's always had a really strong personal connection to victim advocacy and true crime. But for some reason, this really kind of triggered the family, and they decided to like just doggedly go after this. You know, went from being a weekly show to as many as five times a week. Long story short, that show went from around 300,000 monthly listeners to almost 3 million listeners, literally overnight. So it was an amazing experience for us. They also got signed by some big time talent agents, which, you know, we welcome. We ended up, you know, basically kind of like negotiating an exit, kind of selling the rights of that show to another company. And I think everyone won in the end. But one thing I find that fascinating about true crime is that, unlike other genres, TV, arts and culture, no host really has to straddle the line like you guys do between like, how do we build an entertaining show, but then also like be ethical, be respectful of like victims. And I'm always amazed and humbled by the work people are doing in the space.
Yeah. Yeah. I have, it's interesting, cause I don't really have obviously the, you know, people disappearing and, you know, those types of victims. But I always get somebody who will say, you know, oh, well, for somebody to fall for a scam, well, they have to be stupid. But the truth is that's really not true at all. It's very smart people fall for scams all the time, especially if the scam is reasonable, you know, in its pitch, and it makes sense if it worked that way. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't know everything. So, you know, if you say, yeah, I've been investing for this much, and they give you money and you do this and that, and you show them documents and they feel good. And then you've got three of your buddies that have also invested, and you invest. Next thing you know, you lose $100,000 because you and your friends didn't know it was a Ponzi scheme. So, sure. You know, suddenly everybody's like, oh, well, you must have been an idiot. No. I was shown the same documents that any large hedge fund would have shown you. You know, and I had buddies that had been making money in this for over a year. Why wouldn't I invest? Like, these are doctors and lawyers. These aren't stupid people. Mm-hmm. So I always think, you know, people are always, they'll say that, oh, well, that guy must be an idiot. No, that's not true at all. You know, matter of fact, if he was some guy with a low IQ, you know, that was super skeptical because he knew he didn't know any better, he would have been a harder mark.
Sure.
Because he's not sure. So he questions a lot. But because you know it makes sense because you're an active investor and your friends have invested, you accept it because you know how the system works and you know that that's how it works. The problem is there never was an actual investment. It was just a Ponzi scheme. I'm just spending the money on my Ferrari and my $10 million house and my vacations. Like, you see what I'm saying? So, yeah, so that's always a problem with people. I'll get people on the show. They're like, oh, that guy's got to be an idiot. Wait a second. You'd be shocked. So, yeah. But yeah, I think you do have to be. So I think in some ways you definitely have to be cognitive of the fact that lots of people can be victims, you know, and anybody can be a victim, you know. And listen, the human psyche is just bizarre. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, you know, look at like Stockholm syndrome, or, you know, I was watching this thing where the guy, they were interviewing a serial killer where literally he had like a flat tire or something, pulled over with his victim in the car, got out, fixed the flat tire, went to get in the car, and the door was locked. And he knocked on the window, and his victim, who knew he was going to kill her, opened the door. Like, in her mind, she was still thinking, maybe there's a way I can get out of this. She opens the door. The keys were in the car. The car door was locked. She opened the door. He said he killed her within about 30 minutes. Like, why? Because, you know, you just don't understand. You weren't in that situation. You don't know. You know, you can say, oh, she's an idiot. No, she is in terror. And she's thinking, for some reason, that was the right move. It wasn't, but it, for her, that's what gave her a chance to survive.
Yeah. I guess showing compassion for victims, it's a big part of the space, and it's something I'm learning. Definitely.
Well, you know, hindsight is 20/20. Everybody can look back and say, oh, you should have done this, you should have done that. Okay, well, I had about 4 seconds to react. You weren't with me.
Yeah.
You know, sorry. Hey, I appreciate you guys watching. Do me a favor. If you like the video, hit the subscribe button, hit the bell so you get notified of videos just like this. Leave me a comment in the comment section. If you're interested in content like this, please tell me. Also, obviously, I have a Patreon and I have books for sale. I'm on Etsy under Cox Pop Art for paintings. And I really appreciate you guys watching, and thanks a lot. And I'll see you.